Welcome back to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ann Strange-Champs, and today we're doing something special. We are launching our own radio book club, a place where we can celebrate and talk about great fiction, especially by writers of our own culture shed, you could call it, our regional home ground. Wisconsin writers, Midwestern writers, writers who grew up here or who've just arrived. And I am so happy to introduce Benjamin Percy. His new novel, Red Moon, is getting a huge amount of buzz nationally. It's one of the most anticipated books of the summer, just came out. It's a dark political novel about werewolves, or as Ben calls them, lycans. And Ben is not only a gifted writer, he is a former Wisconsinite and a current neighbor. He left us to become writer in residence just across the border at St. Olaf College. And part of Red Moon is actually set in Wisconsin's North Woods. So, readers, what would you like to ask Ben Percy about the story? What was the most remarkable scene in it if you read it? Join the book club conversation at 1-800-642-1234, or if you are a shy person, our email is talk@wpr.org. And Ben, welcome to our first book club.
Thank you so much for having me on.
And congratulations on the new novel.
Thanks. It came out on Tuesday, and I've been jumping from city to city, and I'm thrilled and exhausted.
This is a slightly rude comment, but with a voice like that, you had to write horror, didn't you?
That's right. Well, don't you feel bad for my children? Can you think of me reading you bedtime stories every evening?
Oh, ouch. Yeah,
that is didn't realize that Goodnight Moon was a horror novel, did you?
Does that voice run in the family? Did you inherit it from your dad?
Oh, you should hear my grandmother.
Okay.
It's like in Jurassic Park, when the T-Rex is approaching the car and the water glass is trembling, our voices are felt more than heard.
Wow. I can imagine your whole family at a drive-in.
I'm actually just kidding. When I'm not on the radio, I speak in a whispery falsetto.
Okay, well, we'll try not to wear your vocal cords out this hour. So you are commonly described as writing literary horror. So what is that?
I'm not really sure, to be honest, but People like to label you. You can say that literary fiction is a genre of its own. We're all familiar already with sci-fi, with horror, with fantasy, with mystery, with romance. And I guess you could say that literary fiction is typically thought of as something that has exquisite sentences, subterranean themes, glowing metaphors, and I don't know. I feel like most of the barricades that people set up are phantom barricades. Mm-hmm. I think that if you look at Margaret Atwood, or if you look at Cormac McCarthy, or if you look at Dennis Lehane, or any number of writers, they are doing exactly that. But they also have this compulsive readability to their stories maybe is associated more with pop fiction.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you more about how you craft compulsively readable books. But let's talk a bit about Red Moon and the world you've created in it. So it's a book with werewolves in it, but unlike a lot of the current kind of fantasy books, I guess, it's not a magical world. It's a very realistic world with very, all too, realistic politics.
That's right. This is our world, except for there's that one small difference to it. The infected live among us. And when I was writing this, I didn't want to write about the standard full moon howlers. I wanted to reinvent the mythology. So if you've heard of chronic wasting disease, if you've heard of mad cow disease, you're familiar with prions. And they are a misfolded protein, an animal-based pathogen that, well, targets the mind. In this case, I have the prions leap out of the wolf population in prehistoric times, and if you fast forward to today, roughly 5% of the population is infected. And those infected have issues with rage and sexual impulse. It's, you know, the story of the werewolf is the story of Jekyll and Hyde. It's the story of the Incredible Hulk. It's about the id unleashed. And so this section of the population is marginalized. They are unable to hold certain positions. They're part of a public registry similar to a sex offenders list. They have to take an emotionally deadening drug and succumb to monthly blood tests. And as a result of this, of course, there's an uprising.
And some of them have kind of seceded into a whole separate territory, the Lupine Republic, which is, what, kind of like a giant leper colony?
I guess you could think of it that way. It is located in the borderlands, the icy borderlands between Finland and Russia, you know, a segment of the Earth that nobody really wanted. And it was established in 1948, as I've written it. And so there are parallels you might see to Israel, but there are parallels, too, you might see to Afghanistan or Iraq. And that's sort of what I'm doing on a larger scale, is I'm channeling all of these contemporary parallels, but I'm doing it in a way where you can't point a finger and say that is that, or this is this, or this person is this political figure. You know, I'm holding up a mirror with a crack running through it and warping the reflection.
Yeah, it's fascinating reading because, as you said, there are so many echoes. I mean, you've just listening to you talk about prions, it's clearly a parallel to AIDS and HIV. And there are many, many others. When you run through practically the whole recent history of American civil rights struggles, but you can't ever kind of trace it out and say, oh, okay, he's saying that these people are good and these people are bad. It's more these little references come up like echoes. So why did you want to do that?
Well, I wanted this to be thought-provoking and thrilling at once. And when I think about some of the fantasies that have resonated most with me, when I think about, say, Frankenstein, I see how these stories are very much channeling the cultural unease of the moment. So with Frankenstein, you have all the anxiety swirling around the Industrial Revolution embodied in the creature, the fear of science and technology, the fear of man playing God. If you look to Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you see how that rises out of McCarthyism and the Red Scare. If you look at the Dead Zone, you see Cold War anxieties there. And if you look to all the films and all the books that have come out since 9/11, there's been a slew of apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic narratives.
Mm-hmm.
It's not coincidental.
Right.
So I was thinking about that. I was thinking about, you know, channeling, sort of targeting the nerve of the moment when I was writing about this, making it a post 9/11 reinvention of the werewolf myth.
Well, speaking of post 9/11 scenes, the book opens with this really fairly early into the book, this really horrifying scene. It's a lycan or werewolf terrorist attack on a plane, but clear references to 9/11. Could you actually read some of that scene? Did you bring your book with you?
I did bring it, yes.
Okay, could we hear some of that?
Sure thing.
Maybe you can set it up for us.
Okay, so we open up at the San Francisco International Airport on a flight to Portland, Oregon, and we have two characters we're following at this time. The first chapter is braided. One of them, Patrick Gamble, who is one of many central characters in this novel, is headed there to live with his mother as his father is going overseas to fight in the Lupine Republic. The other character is a shady sort of man who appears a businessman with his nunbush loafers shine to an opal glow in his charcoal suit and everything else, but he seems a bit tense. And we follow him and we follow Patrick. And then as the flight takes off, something happens. The man rises and goes to the restroom. A little bit later on, a noise is heard. And it sounds a bit like metal being torn, but it has an animal undertone as well, and everybody on the plane goes dead silent and turns around, and then the bathroom door crashes open. So, cover your ears if you're a sensitive type. A bald man in a Rose Bowl sweatshirt is the first in line for the restroom, and so he is the first to die. The door jars him back. He would have fallen except for the narrow hallway where he stands, the wall catching him and preventing any further retreat as the thing emerges from the restroom, rushing forward like a gray wraith, a blurred mass of hair and muscle and claws. It swings an arm. The bald man's scream is cut short, his throat excised and replaced by a second red mouth that he brings his hands to as if he could hold the blood in place. But it sprays between his fingers. As if to make up for his sudden silence, the rest of the passengers begin to scream, all of their voices coming together like a siren that rises and falls. The thing begins to move up the aisle.
Whoa. Yeah, and I will say the gore gets worse as we go on. So there's so many.
But there are many sensitive moments as well.
Gore. Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. There's something that seems sort of disturbing about writing gory scenes that are also beautiful. Does that bother you?
I don't know that it bothers me to write pretty sentences about terrible things, but it does, of course, bother me to sometimes hold up a lantern to the abyss. But as these last few weeks have so unfortunately reminded us, these sorts of things happen, and these sorts of things grip us and own us and paralyze us. And it's necessary to write about them, not just as a way of sort of taking a microscope to our, you know, to our culture, but to better understand the human condition.
Mm. So speaking of, we're talking about that as clearly a piece of post 9/11, and I think especially because of 9/11, that's a really horrifying scene. You know, after 9/11, none of us sits in a plane with the same degree of relaxation that we used to have. I'm curious, so on the one hand, you could say, well, as a writer, you're sort of capitalizing on our collective trauma, or you could say that as a writer, you know, you're writing as a form of almost collective therapy, so you're sort of channeling and maybe offering a way to heal some of our collective trauma. I don't know, what do you think?
Well, I feel that, you know, art isn't meant to answer questions. It's meant to raise questions. And when I'm writing about a political subject, I'm doing my best not to be polemical. When I was, in 2005, when I was reading all of these articles about the war in Iraq, I set out to write a work of fiction. And I had not read any at that moment. There have been many since that time. But at the moment, I hadn't read any. So I set out with the express purpose of somehow wrestling with the war in Iraq. And when I did that, I did not want to say that war is good or war is bad, but instead this is war. And it's a very complicated, knotty subject. In the same way, when I'm writing about, you could say, this post-9/11 environment, I have characters who are the infected, and I have characters who are the uninfected. I have characters who are young and characters who are old, male and female, from all sorts of different cultural and economic and geographic and religious backgrounds. And as a result of that, these myriad perspectives, there is no editorializing. And instead, it is there merely to provoke conversation.
Mm. We're talking
to make us think again about news that might be buried on page 6 instead of a headline.
Right. We're talking with Benjamin Percy about his new novel, Red Moon. He's also written a first novel, The Wilding, as well as two books of short stories, Refresh, Refresh, and The Language of Elk. He's currently writer in residence at St. Olaf College in Minnesota. And this is Book Club Hour, which means that Ben is here to answer your questions, not just mine. So if you read Red Moon or the excerpt we posted, was there a scene that really jumped out for you? If you're a horror fiction fan, what's the first book you ever read that kept you awake at night or scared you too much to sleep? You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or if you are shy, email us. And that address is talk@wpr.org. ideasnetwork.org. I'm Ann Strange Jampson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hey, later this hour, independent bookseller Daniel Golden from Milwaukee's Boswell's Books will be along with suggestions for what to read next. First, we're talking with Ben Percy, the author of the new novel Red Moon. And, oh, incidentally, Ben will be appearing at Boswell's Books in Milwaukee next week, the 13th, I think. Is that right, Ben?
That's right, yeah. And Boswell Books and Daniel Golden.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite bookstores in the country, so I'm really excited to visit there. Amazing man, a man of letters. So
he is.
Everybody should frequent that store and tune in for his interview.
Wait, wow. I absolutely agree, and I think they're really looking forward to having you there. So if you want to meet Ben in person or have him sign a copy of your book, he'll be at Boswell's in Milwaukee next week. But and again, if you want to join our conversation, if you've got a question for Ben or want to talk about what's the scariest story you ever read, you can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. So, Ben, we were talking about writing political allegory, and I want to ask you to sort of just describe a little bit more of what happens in this book and the way the political situations play out, because there are just so many echoes I like the verb you just used, braided in here. So what happens?
Well, as a result of this initial terror attack, which has been a long time coming, due to restrictions and on the infected, due to their marginalization as members of society, after this attack, there is a swift government response, and you see some people justly persecuted, and you see others who are victims of hate crimes. There are neo-Nazi groups that rise up. There are people bothering their neighbors and people they once thought of as friends, gripped as they are by terror. And things sort of swirl out of control from there. And by the end of the novel, we're in a state of almost civil war.
Yeah. And I've read before that you do a kind of writing you think of as method writing, in the sense that you do a ton of research. So what did you read when you were constructing all of the political ramifications?
Yeah, I do. I treat every story as a research project. So if I'm writing about a taxidermist, say, I'm visiting a taxidermy studio and I'm clacking those glass eyeballs around in my palm, and I'm sniffing the formaldehyde and stroking the polyurethane forms and interviewing the taxidermist and trying to figure out their point of view, their language, that insider lingo that can be so interesting. And in the same way, when I approached Red Moon, I realized how many things I did not know. So I don't know what it means to be a government agent. I don't know what it means to be a brewmaster. I don't know what it means to be a soldier overseas. I don't know what it means to be a vaccine researcher. And I spent a great deal of time with the USDA labs and with researchers at Iowa State University trying to figure out the slippery science behind all of this, and filled up probably 12 yellow legal tablets. And the same thing goes for the political angle of this novel. One of my characters is a governor who ends up running for president. There is a lot going on, you know, when it comes to the day-to-day business and when it comes to the political angling and when it comes to just the emotional ramifications of taking on that kind of responsibility that I don't understand. So had to tune in to documentaries, had to watch TV shows like The West Wing and pick up novels written by Tom Clancy and read articles in newspapers and magazines in order to figure out all of those little details that result in a foundation of credibility, so that it seems as though these characters are authentic and not made of ink and paper, but instead of flesh and blood.
So in the In the book, the Lycans, werewolves, have been fighting for their civil rights for a couple of generations. And it's a struggle that got very heated in one decade, then quieted down, and then heated up again. And you make pretty clear references to, I mean, they're sort of Lycan versions of Kent State back in their history. They're versions of the recent protests. I'm trying to think of the... Mm-hmm.
Occupy.
The thank
Occupy.
You. Yes, that's the word I was looking for. There are echoes of Occupy. Is that... I'm curious if that long kind of history is the way you see the American political climate today, in the sense of, are there political struggles that we tend to see as individual and then they're over and done, but you're suggesting that, in fact, maybe they're all part of a longer political struggle that we've been engaged in for generations?
I think so.
Am I making the sense? That's kind of a convoluted question.
When I was writing this, I had to think about that crack in the mirror I was talking about before. I've changed this one thing that the infected live among us. But I had to go back. I had to do some reverse engineering and think about just about how that might affect contemporary America, but how that has affected global history. So lycans are persecuted in the Crusades. Lycans are subjected to genocide during World War II. Lycans are part of the civil rights movement. Lycans are, battling back in a similar way to the Occupy movement against the establishment that attempts to push them into the corner. So, yeah, I feel like there is something very cyclical about many of these struggles, and people raising a fist and setting their jaw and battling back those who wish to oppress.
We've got a caller on the line from Janesville. Vincent has a question or a comment. Hey, Vincent, thanks for joining us.
Hi. So I was kind of curious. You had prompted earlier about questions as to the scariest stories you'd heard as a child. Now, I had read Goosebumps and I'd read the scary stories that you tell in the dark. But the scariest thing to me was, and a lot of kids that I knew, was the pictures that they had found with the book. And those were the ones that were very imaginative. They didn't really fit at all with the stories, but they were just ghastly and very interesting. But I was just wondering if he had any certain interesting perspective as far as choosing the cover art for his book or anything like that for his short stories, or if I don't know if he had any artistic perspective like that, I guess.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Ben.
Well, I am very interested in artwork as it relates to horror, and I in fact have a book called The Art of Horror Stories that takes you through all the pulpy comics and through movie posters and books like Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark and everything else. But I was a obsessive reader of Tales from the Crypt and the Vault of Horror, those EC comics from back in the day. But as for whether I have any input on the cover of my book, that's not really, the author isn't typically involved in that sort of decision making. Thankfully, I really love it. It has this shimmery underglow. It's there's kind of a silvery underlining to the jacket so that it appears to move and wink at you as you move past it. And the bare branches over the red moon. It's eerie and lovely at the same time. But right now I am involved a little bit in that, that sort of a artistic decision making, in that I am composing a graphic novel and working with an artist on that. So I'm not the one who sketches anything out, but it's a pleasure to sort of write a script that cues the artist to imagine what I imagine.
Hmm. Aren't you also working on the screenplay for your previous novel with that's the guy who did 21 Gram and
Guillermo Arriaga, yeah.
Yeah, and Babel,
yes,
right?
Yes, I've worked with him on that and drafted away, and it is in pre-production limbo, which is pretty much the standard of Hollywood. And I am also right now fielding some offers on Red Moon. I'm really excited about that. And one of the scenarios so far I'm approaching a studio as co-screenwriter, which would be a real pleasure. But nothing is definitive at this point. It's all,
well,
it's all
so,
speculation.
But so talk a little bit about the business of translating translating literature or a printed piece into film, sort of the pros and cons. I mean, I think this is on everybody's mind this weekend because The Great Gatsby is out on film. And so we're all thinking about, oh, does it ruin the book to have the film made or not?
Well, when I was adapting The Wilding, it gave me a second chance at the novel. The way I am, the minute I finish something, I'm dissatisfied with it, which is a good thing. If I'm standing at the podium before a room full of people, I'll likely be revising sentences and skipping paragraphs. And I like the fact that I'm not satisfied with my work because that means I'm chasing a learning curve, that I haven't plateaued. And when I was writing The Wilding as a screenplay, it was a reboot opportunity. I could change some of the things that I now disliked about that novel. And I also was able to shift the aesthetic to suit Guillermo's sensibilities. So if you've seen 21 Grams or if you've seen Babel, you know that he always works in this non-linear style.
Mm-hmm.
He shifts scenes around so they don't move in a straight line. And when I was writing The Wilding as a screenplay, you know, I guess you could say that this sort of thing could be gimmicky. It has to have, though, ideally, a reason for the style to match the content. In 21 Grams, the couple has lost their child, so their lives are fragmented, and that nonlinear style suits the material. So with The Wilding, I was able to create the sense by fragmenting the structure that you were lost in the woods, and that was a lot of fun.
Hmm.
And I also, though, some of the frustrations are you just don't have enough time to translate your whole book into a screenplay. So I had to merge some of the characters. I had to figure out which scenes to cut. And it's a tricky sort of process, especially since you have to step back so much. As a novelist, you're able to leap into people's heads and you're able to describe the sets and you're able to describe the costumes and the lighting and everything else. You have total control. And with a screenplay, it's always just about, it's more about white space than text if you look at a script. Just being barely suggestive and supplying mostly dialogue.
Mm. We've got another caller. Mary in Westfield has some thoughts about good and evil in literature and religion. Am I getting it right, Mary?
Yes. I grew up in a family that believed that I'm 70 years old, so it's quite a while ago, but as a child, I was terrorized by the stories of an evil, not evil, but a wrathful and angry and vengeful God. And I used to have nightmares about it. And I had to read the Bible three times before I was 12 years old, including all the begots. And there are some really horror stories in the Old Testament, of men sacrificing their daughters because men are more important than women, and their daughters being chopped into pieces and left on their doorstep and things like that. And I just wondered how, and then the history of the Crusades. I mean, these were rapers and pillagers, and yet we sort of canonized them in the cleansed Christian religion. I just wondered if you ever thought about that or wrote about that or how that, I mean, I had nightmares into my adulthood about the horror stories that my parents told me, and yet it was supposed to be this religion that I embraced. I wondered if that ever entered.
Yeah, let's get an answer. Ben, did you grow up with any kind of religious background?
Not particularly. But I am fascinated with the stories in the Bible and am particularly interested in Revelations, which, with its apocalyptic visions is incredibly gripping and imagistic. Mm. The horsemen haunt my dreams as well. But I am at present, I have another novel coming out in June of 2014 that's a post-apocalyptic reimagining of the Lewis and Clark saga. But after that novel, I'm I'm building right now. I'm about 60 pages into this new idea, and it's kind of The Matrix meets The Exorcist. So I am dealing with good and evil. I'm dealing with demons, and as a result, I am mining the Bible for some of those stories that resonate most.
That's fascinating. We also had an email from Bridget in Palmyra who says, the first novel I read that really scared me was The Shining by Stephen King. I've reread it several times over the years, and it still gives me the chills. I find myself comparing creepy basements to the image in my mind that I created of the Overlook's basement. And she says, horror novels are so much scarier than horror movies because my imagination has a lot more room to terrify me.
I like that. I like the idea of the white space on a page. Like, let's say you write some scene that moves towards some horror leaping out of a closet, and the white space that follows it, your imagination fills in.
Yeah.
And you become a participant. You become a co-author. And that, of course, is far more startling than a filmmaker feeding you an image. And I think that it was Stephen King in his nonfiction book Dance Macabre who talked about how the most terrifying moment in any horror film or in any horror story is when somebody hears a noise and moves toward it. And it's all about that moment of withheld information. The suspense as they move toward some darkness and peer into it, whether that's a basement or an attic or a snap stick off in the woods and they're moving through the trees or they're deep in a cave or wherever else, there's that noise out there. And whenever the noise is finally revealed, we laugh or we gasp. It's always, though, with a bit of disappointment that the thing, the mystery, is finally revealed, meaning it's the mystery that matters because that's when you, sometimes as a viewer, sometimes as a reader, that's when you are complicit in the horror.
That's so interesting because it also suggests that there actually is something we're hungry for in horror.
Well, sure. That's why we get onto roller coasters. That's why every kid's favorite game is, Daddy, be a monster and chase me.
What is it we're hungry for?
We love the thrill of it. What's that?
What is it we're hungry for?
I think that, we want our pulse to race. We want to feel more alive than our safe domestic surroundings allow. We want our lives to be more exciting. You never feel more alive than when you stand next to a cliff and put your foot out over it as a kind of dare and then step back, right? So we're daring the nightmare and doing it in a safe sort of way.
That's, yeah. And I'm also thinking then about your earlier comments about the animal within. Maybe what we're hungry for is the pure animal existence inside us. We're hungry for the heightened senses.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, some people have said that this novel is a departure for me, but I only see it as a departure stylistically, in that this is a long novel, an epic, sweeping novel, and everything I've written before this has been sort of compact. But when it comes to my characters and my subject matter, some people are saying that, this is a leap and that it's supernatural. But really, all along, I've been writing about characters who are hairy on the inside, as we all are. When the shades go down, when society isn't looking, sometimes we let the animal off the chain.
You have this, we're not going to have time for you to read it, but there's this gorgeous passage in the book. There's a teenage girl who's Lycan, but who's never transformed very much. And there's a scene where you describe what it feels like to her to transform. And it's beautiful. I mean, you tell me how you imagine. It's like everything comes alive in her.
Yeah, if you think of that landmark moment in cinema in An American Werewolf in London, I think the transformation scene in there lasted 7 minutes or more. And it's incredibly visceral. One body overtakes another. And I wanted that same sense of almost a birth. And as her body transforms, so does her mind, in that she taps into a singular instinct and becomes more tooth and claw in the way she engages with the world. And I think that we all have that, of course, inside of us. We need only to be pushed to the edge sometimes to realize it. So,
you also, I like it very much that it's the one werewolf whose transformation you described from the first person is a young woman, and you've got some wonderful female characters in the novel. I can't let you go without asking. This is a complete change of pace, but you recently wrote a piece about wearing a custom-made pregnancy suit. For why did you do that?
Well, because I always take on nonfiction projects as stunts. You know, I leap out of a plane and write about it. I hang glide off the side of a mountain and write about it. I have climbed a 250-foot tree, old-growth tree, and spent the night in it. I have gone on an insane diet where I ate only veggies and fruits and drank only water for 21 days. And so the pregnancy suit was just another one of those stunt articles. And the idea behind it was not to wear the stupid pregnancy suit, but the idea was to account for the shifting role, masculine role in society. I have so many friends right now who are stay-at-home dads. I have so many friends who are including myself. We're participants, equal participants in the rearing of our children. And if you look at my father's generation, the generation before that, you know, my grandfather never held a baby. My father never changed a diaper. And these days, that's grounds for divorce. So it was about that sort of this era of male empathy, I guess you could say. That's why it was assigned to me.
So what was this thing that you wore?
Oh, it was I traveled to Japan to wear this high-tech pregnancy suit that they developed there called the Mommy Tummy. And it heated up and it swelled with weight. And there was even a computer readout that would show the stage of pregnancy and what your child would look like within. And if you rubbed the belly, it would soothe the kicking inside, because there were all sorts of balloons within the suit that gave you sort of a fluttering feel and a prodding feel. And so, obviously, it's a completely inadequate replication.
Yes, having gone through it twice, I can tell you there's a fair amount you're missing there. But
that's the whole point is in writing about it is, you know, I made fun of myself endlessly just saying that this is, you know, I'm not man enough to be a woman, essentially.
You wore this for 9 weeks, though. That's a long time.
Well, I'm a fiction writer first. You can only count on.
All right. Well, you wore it for a while.
Being true.
What did your kids say?
Well, they said at first, this is funny and weird. And then, you know, I just wore it on and off and at humorous intervals in order to best inform my article.
And did you ever go into a bar wearing it, or what would happen if you grocery shopping?
Or the grocery store.
What did people say anything, or did they?
Well, of course, yeah. There's a guy in a pregnancy suit. That's kind of weird.
Is that what they said, or did they say, "What's wrong with you"? Or
yes. That's the general sort of, I think, response to anyone who has ever seen a man in a pregnancy suit or read an article about a man in a pregnancy suit. What's wrong with you?
I don't know. I think we can declare you an honorary feminist now. But though I will say, okay. I would be more impressed if you'd taken, hormone shots so you could experience ricochet.
I really should have just. That's what my wife was really hoping for. She's like, can I just jab a needle in you? Or maybe, crank up the thermostat to 120 degrees and you know, set a hot brick on your bladder.
there's some things you're missing.
She was teasing me endlessly.
All right. Well, Ben, stay on the line with us. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got Daniel Golden joining us, independent bookseller from Milwaukee's Boswell's Books. And he'll be along with suggestions for what to read next. You're listening to 45 North on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to 45 North, and we've been talking with Ben Percy. His new novel, Red Moon, is just out. It's been one of the most hotly anticipated new releases, and he'll be at Boswell's Books next week on the 13th, signing books and giving a reading. And we've also got independent bookseller Daniel Golden with us. Hey, Daniel.
Hi, how are you?
Great. And Ben's along here, too, so thanks for joining us.
Hey, Daniel. How you doing?
Hey, nice to see you. We will see you next week, which is, by the way, on the 14th.
Oh, the 14th. Thank you. Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry. I got it wrong. Okay, the 14th. I should have checked.
We hope they'll show up both nights.
Okay. Maybe so. Well, so, Daniel, if we want to keep the literary horror mood going, what should we read next?
Well, I have been... me and the other booksellers have just been going crazy with suggestions. I am a bit of a delicate flower, and so I'm not always the best person. But one of the things that's interesting about Ben's books is that I have read all the books up to now, and if somebody wanted to get the feel for it, but you know, had stomach issues, I guess they would definitely go back and read The Wilding, which I love, and as we heard, it's going to be a movie. Stacy, one of our booksellers, put together a werewolf table, of course, and we've had a number of books on there, though none as good as Spandman's, of course. But there are a few. One is The Last Werewolf by Glenn Duncan, and that has a lot of enthusiasm among booksellers as well. One of the things is it is a trilogy, which seems to be what a lot of these things fall into. Your book's a standalone, though, right?
Yeah, I proposed it initially as a trilogy, just trying to be like all the other cool kids on the block. And then they made me compose it as one big sweeping novel, which I'm glad
you know,
I
love that, because I'm so intimidated at the end of those books. Another book that we recommend is The Passage by Justin Cronin, which sort of was one of the first uber literary people that jumped into the genre. His book is a vampire novel, but I thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to read 3,000 pages.
I remember when that came. Yeah, when that came to work, I just thought, oh no, I don't have the energy. What's it about?
It is a virus has infected mankind and creates vampire creatures. It is one of those books. It starts and that he has a prologue, and then it jumps. Was it a couple hundred years later, I think, when the world has been messed up? It combines the elements of the horror novel and the thriller novel. I think what it doesn't have, which Ben's has, is the whole, war element.
The politics.
The political element.
And the politics. I think you've built a lot more politics into the book, making it a fine book club selection.
Now, you also mentioned The Last Werewolf by Glenn Duncan. I'm not familiar with that one either.
Duncan's written a number of books. I think he's actually been front page New York Times Book Review twice. And this is much more of a, a very different kind of book. I don't think it's as much of an action novel, Last Werewolf. It follows this one guy, Jacob Marlowe, who, I almost think of it as sort of being similar more to maybe the Anne Rice as vampire model.
So it's more of a relationship story?
Yeah, of course.
Well, there's lots of Randy werewolves in his, I think.
Yeah, maybe it's relationships if you mean sex, you mean?
That's one kind of relationship.
I was trying to look for, we're always looking for people with some local ties. There's a horror novel that we really love called Those Across the River by Christopher Buhlmann. It is a sort of a southern kind of blends horror with maybe a little southern gothic to it. And the interesting thing about the book, it's very Stephen King-esque. Jason's a big fan, our buyer. But the other thing is Buhlman actually performs at a Renaissance Fair, the Bristol Renaissance Fair, every summer as an insult comic. And that's actually how we not only, you know, we read the book first. Several of my bookstores read it, loved the book, and then he showed up buying books on his way home, you know, on his break from Kenosha.
So are there lots of creative insults in the book?
No, it's a totally, this is one of those things, like it's very different from his performance art. Like a completely different person, which is, of course, I'm jealous of, because everything I do sounds exactly the same.
But so these are all male writers. Aren't there any women working in this genre?
Good thing that you said that to me, because I had the same sort of struggle, and we did come up with one. Now, of course, there are tons of women writers, but many of them are in the teen genre, where they're the subset of horror with the dystopian world. There's plenty of violence in some. I have this theory that women who write these kind of books are pushed into teen writing more than men. There's a wonderful book called Reboot by Amy Tintera that just came out about these killer forces. Like, they revive people who've died, teenage people who've died, and turn them into killers. And the longer you've been dead, the more soulless you are. It's a very violent book. I don't know why it's a teen novel. I wonder if it had been written, submitted by a man, because many of these books are written originally as adult novels, if it wouldn't have been kept as an adult novel.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting thing. I actually read a lot of young adult fiction. I just like it. Maybe I have a teenager inside of me. I also think that if you create a character who is young or a teenager, you're automatically assumed to be writing YA fiction, as though you can't write in a book about a teenager for adults.
I think a lot of authors are finding that to be the case. The opposite, it sort of switches back, because a very large market of those teen novels are women in their 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. I did come up with one woman who wrote a dystopian novel, which they kept as an adult book. It's Pure by Juliana Baggett. And interestingly enough, she also came from the world, crossed over from the world of literary fiction. She was a poet. She wrote, I remember well, her first novel, Girl Talk. It's a women's coming-of-age book, Girl Talk. I mean, you can't think of an idea softer. And this is a post-apocalyptic, the detonations, and everybody is mutated, and people are, she, I think, just has a doll in her hand, but other people are connected to animals or the ground, and very brutal, very violent. Good.
So it also sounds like...
That's a great book, yeah.
It is?
I'd highly recommend that one.
So... And has she influenced your writing at all, do you think?
No, but we're friends. So
you were probably writing at the same time, I would
say. Yeah. I think that we wrote and released our books around the same moment.
And does hers also deal, as yours does, with this disease theme?
No, it's about a nuclear fallout that results, as Daniel was saying, in people fusing. So... when the horizon flashed and the heat rolled over you, if you were holding a doll, the doll is now fused to you. So you might have, coming out of your hand, a sort of molten dolly. Or if some people were holding their babies, like mothers holding their babies at the time, so their children are sort of growing out of their shoulders and so on. And as Daniel said, some people are fused to the earth and everything else, and it's... just really exquisitely beautiful writing, in addition to being terrifying.
It sounds wonderful and horrifying, and I'm horrified that we are running out of time. It's been really great to talk with you guys. Daniel, we'll have you on again soon.
Pleasure.
That's Daniel Golden. He is independent bookseller at Boswell's Books in Milwaukee, and on the 14th next week, Ben Percy will be there signing books and reading if you want to meet him in person and you live in the area. I'm Anne Strange, and we've been talking with Ben. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. I hope to see some people next week at Boswell.
Sounds good. Ben Percy talking about his brand new novel, Red Moon, which is getting a lot of press. I'm Anne Strangechamps. 45 North, produced by Marika Suval and Rhonda Fanning. Technical radio wizardry from Dave Potraz, lots of other people. Thank you so much, and we'll be back next week.